where the crowd is literally a laugh track from the 1960s. I don't understand why CNN put their own employee in this position. But
yeah, so this is part of the argument I made about Caitlin Collins. You know, there is praise and criticism of Caitlin Collins, but putting her in that position with a sycophant crowd is part of the friendly nature in total with which Trump was given this opportunity. Let's listen to another caller about the Trump town hall. I think this is the Eggman.
I watched Trump and Caitlin Collins on CNN last night like it was a homework assignment.
Yeah.
I watched it like I had to do it because it was something I needed to report on. My wife was watching with me. She walked out of the room. It upset her so much. She can't stand Trump that much. She couldn't even listen anymore. But I forced myself to watch. I can't wait to hear what you have to say.
Yeah.
Shalom.
Shalom. The Eggman, quite appalled by it. And here's one more caller weighing in.
Hi. Yeah, Dave. Semi-long-time listener, about maybe less than a year. I watched the Trump, or listened to the Trump town hall, and it was pretty, within 5 minutes of listening, I was just like, this is a waste of time. Mm. I mean, I get why CNN did it. I mean, but we didn't learn anything about Trump that we didn't already know.
That's true. But we learned a lot about the state of Trump sycophants, because when you look at when the crowd laughed and when the crowd cheered, it was at the absolute bottom of the barrel moments when Trump attacked his own sexual assault victim during the event. The crowd laughed and cheered. When Trump attacked the moderator, Caitlin Collins, the crowd laughed and cheered. When Trump said he actually won in 2020, the crowd cheered. The crowd was actually what was new. Trump did his greatest hits, and it was truly, truly horrible. We've got a great bonus show for you today. We'll talk about the latest out of the Supreme Court. We're going to talk about Fox News hit with yet another defamation lawsuit. And we will also talk about Senator representing California, Dianne Feinstein's return to the Senate for the first time since February amid calls for her to resign. We'll discuss the entire circumstances around her return all on the bonus show.
Thank your lucky stars every day. You're not Dave Pakman.
You don't have to be me to listen to the bonus show or to watch it. I'll host it. You watch it. Sign up at joinpakman.com. Otherwise, we'll be back tomorrow.
WRCT in sound from way out.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house! Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Folks, glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRC.
RCT Pittsburgh. Jazz is a one-syllable word.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Behind us, we have migrants who are asylum seekers, who some of whom have been here for 6 days, 7 days. Some of them are just arrived last night, and they are in squalid conditions. Don't have access to food or to water.
The Trump-era Title 42 policy has come to an end, but the Biden administration's instituted what critics say is a new asylum ban. We'll go to San Diego to look at what's happening at the border. This comes as a group of House Democrats are urging the Biden administration to lift sanctions on Venezuela and Cuba, which they say are driving people to leave their homes out of economic desperation. Then we look at the political crisis in Pakistan. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been freed on bail 3 days after his arrest sparked mass protests. And we go to Belgrade, Serbia, which is reeling after 17 people were shot dead in two massacres last week, including Serbia's first ever school shooting, where the shooter was a 13-year-old.
The government has proposed very stringent measures to, as the president put it, to disarm Serbia.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Title 42, the Trump-era pandemic policy that was used to expel nearly 3 million asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border without due process, was lifted Thursday just before midnight after 3 years of enforcement. Thousands of migrants have been stranded across the southern border, hoping to be processed and allowed into the United States. But many will likely be blocked as the Biden administration begins implementing what immigration rights advocates have denounced as another ban on the right to seek asylum under domestic and international law. A new policy announced this week would force the majority of asylum seekers to request refugee status in another country before reaching the U.S. or face quick deportation. The ACLU and others are suing over the rule. Another directive requires asylum applicants to make their appointments on a Customs and Border Protection smartphone app that asylum applicants say is riddled with software bugs and raises serious concerns over privacy. At the San Ysidro border crossing in California, hundreds of asylum seekers have been sleeping on the ground under trash bags and foil blankets, with many reporting they've not eaten in days. This is Hashmatullah Habibi, an asylum seeker from Afghanistan, who said Thursday he and his family have nowhere else to go.
Oh, I'm just hoping and praying that today they take us in, because if they don't take us in, then my future and my family future is in dark. Because we escaped from dark place, dark side, and we came here for a better life. And if they not take us in, the situation will be more awful for us, because we cannot go back and we cannot come in. So it's like dying situation.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection has detained some 28,000 migrants at its border facilities in recent days. Meanwhile, the number of asylum seekers attempting to cross into the United States has topped 10,000 a day as people continue to flee violence, extreme poverty, and the impacts of the climate crisis. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas Thursday warned migrants arriving at the border of even harsher consequences.
If anyone arrives at our southern border after midnight tonight, they will be presumed ineligible for asylum and subject to steeper consequences for unlawful entry, including a minimum 5-year ban on reentry and potential criminal prosecution.
we'll go to San Diego for the latest from the U.S.-Mexico border. The former Marine who killed the beloved street performer Jordan Neely is expected to be arrested today for second-degree manslaughter. Video shows Daniel Penny held Neely in a chokehold for 15 minutes on a New York City subway train May 1st, leading to Neely's death. Penny was questioned by police shortly after the killing, but was initially released without charge. Meanwhile, protests continue in New York demanding justice for Jordan Neely. This is Selena Trowell, an organizer at Vocal New York.
But we need accountability, and that comes from the mayor and the governor, because his death is on their hands for legitimizing that type of murder.
To see our conversation about Jordan Neely, go to democracynow.org. Prospects for a ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Islamic Jihad have faded after a lull in fighting. Israeli warplanes have resumed bombing the Gaza Strip, and Palestinians fired hundreds of long-range rockets into Israel and toward illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. A 70-year-old man was killed Thursday when a rocket crashed into the Israeli city of Rehovot. At least 31 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli assaults, including children. This is Melina Al-Hindi, a 39-year-old mother living in Khan Yunis.
We feel unsafe, even at home. We go in and out of the house, but we are afraid. One could be going down the street when a rocket hits, never to return. We don't know what will happen to us and to our children. This situation in Gaza is not normal. It is terrifying, beyond anything you can imagine.
In Sudan, warring parties have signed an agreement pledging to protect civilians and allowing for humanitarian aid to safely reach them. The Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces failed to agree to a ceasefire as talks continue in Saudi Arabia. Since fighting broke out April 15th, more than 600 people have been killed. At least 18 of those were humanitarian workers. Over 700,000 people have been internally displaced. In Pakistan, former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been released on bail on orders from the Islamabad High Court after Pakistan's Supreme Court Thursday ruled his arrest was invalid and unlawful. Khan is accused of multiple corruption charges, and his arrest has sparked widespread protests. At least 8 people have been killed, some 2,000 arrested in the ensuing violence. As Khan's supporters prepared to march on the capital, police issued an emergency order banning gatherings by more than 4 people. In Guinea, protests against the military government resumed Thursday, one day after activists said at least 7 people were killed and dozens injured in demonstrations across the country. The military took control over the West African nation after a 2021 coup and have been slow to transition leadership back to a democratically elected government. This is a resident of the capital, Conakry.
If it continues like this, it won't be good. I don't like demonstrations. We like peace. These protests are really tiring, and we are exhausted.
International travelers arriving in the United States will no longer have to show proof of vaccination against COVID-19. The requirement was lifted as the U.S. government Thursday formally ended its public health emergency in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Last week, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 is no longer a global health emergency. COVID-19 has killed more than 1.1 million people around the United States, though that's widely believed to be a significant undercount. Globally, there have been nearly 7 million officially reported deaths. The true death toll is unknown, but the UN estimates at least 20 million. A judge in Virginia has struck down a federal law prohibiting the sale of handguns to 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, ruling the ban is an unconstitutional violation of the Second Amendment. The Justice Department will likely ask the judge to put the ruling on hold while it appeals the decision. The gun control advocacy group Everytown Law said Thursday's ruling will put lives at risk, adding, quote, "Not only are guns the leading cause of death for U.S. kids and teens, but research shows us that 18 to 20-year-olds commit gun homicides at triple the rate of adults 21 years and older," unquote. in Texas. The State House of Representatives on Thursday approved a bill banning devices that can turn handguns into fully automatic firearms. The devices, commonly called Glock switches, are already illegal under federal law. Texas lawmakers did not advance a bill that would have raised the age to purchase a semi-automatic assault rifle to 21. This came as high school students across Texas walked out of classes Thursday to demand new laws preventing gun violence. Their protest came less than a week after the mass shooting in Allen, Texas. The Supreme Court has ruled in favor of a transgender woman from Guatemala who's challenging her deportation. The justices unanimously backed Estrella Santos Zacaria, who now has another chance to argue for her right to asylum as she faces persecution back home. Santos Zacaria fled to the United States after being raped as a young teenager and threatened with death because she is transgender. And in another ruling, the Supreme Court sided with a California law that seeks to breed pigs more humanely by banning pork sales from farms where the animals are kept in confined spaces. The pork industry, which challenged the law, argued it infringed on individual state regulations where producers are based. Writing for the majority in a narrow 5-4 ruling, conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch said, quote, "While the Constitution addresses many weighty issues, the type of pork chops California merchants may sell is not on that list." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show at the U.S.-Mexico border, where the pandemic policy known as Title 42, which was used to expel nearly 3 million asylum seekers without due process, was lifted Thursday at midnight, 3 years after it was implemented by Trump. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas announced the change while warning migrants of harsher consequences if they attempt to cross into the United States.
Let me be clear. The lifting of the Title 42 public health order does not mean our border is open. In fact, it is the contrary. Our use of our immigration enforcement authorities under Title 8 of the United States Code means tougher consequences for people who cross the border illegally. Unlike under Title 42, an individual who is removed under Title 8 is subject to at least a 5-year bar on re-entry into the United States and can face criminal prosecution if they attempt to cross again. We are conducting dozens of removal flights per week, and we continue to increase our removal flight capability. We are increasing our efficiency and reducing processing times at the border.
As Title 42 ends, thousands of migrants have been stranded across the southern border hoping to be processed and allowed into the United States. This is a Venezuelan asylum seeker near the San Ysidro border crossing in California.
We got off one train to take another. The situation is challenging. All of us who are here are from Venezuela. Many migrants are in the same situation. It is difficult and complex. Every time they put more and more obstacles in our way, we will continue to move forward.
Most of the thousands seeking entry to the United States will likely be blocked as the Biden administration begins its implementation of what immigration rights advocates say is another ban on the right to seek asylum under both domestic and international law. A policy announced this week would force most asylum seekers to request refugee status in another country like Mexico before reaching the U.S. or face quick deportation. The ACLU and others are suing over the rule. Another directive requires asylum applicants to make their appointments on a Customs and Border Protection smartphone app that asylum seekers say is riddled with software bugs and raises serious concerns over privacy. Meanwhile, migrant detentions at the U.S.-Mexico border are hitting record highs as Title 42 ends. Border Patrol authorities said Wednesday they detained a record 28,000 people. For more, we go to San Diego, which is near the San Ysidro border crossing in California, where hundreds of asylum seekers have been sleeping on the ground under trash bags and foil blankets, with many reporting they haven't eaten in days. We're joined by Pedro Rios, director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico border program. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Pedro. Can you talk about the situation as of midnight last night? But, of course, this has been building up.
Thank you, Amy. Yes, what we are seeing on the ground is that there are many people who are wanting to seek asylum, and as they cross into what is known as the enforcement zone, which is between the primary and the secondary border walls, is that they are essentially being left there, and Border Patrol is not providing, is not abiding by its national standards to ensure that they have safety, that they get food, that they have plenty of water and shelter. At this time, what we see is on a rotating basis, at least 400 people, asylum seekers with many children, who have been abandoned in this location until and waiting until Border Patrol picks them up.
So can you talk about how the Biden administration is dealing with this and talk about what people are telling you on the border, what they understand has changed?
The Biden administration is dealing with this very poorly. Essentially, it's placing even more obstacles for people that are fleeing harm by placing bans, by ensuring that people don't have a way to seek asylum, by forcing people to have to cross through these inhumane ways, and furthermore, ensuring that they are hungry, that they are thirsty. And when we speak with migrants on the ground, they tell us that they have no other options. They have tried using the CBP One application on their phone, and oftentimes it just doesn't work for them. There aren't many opportunities for them to present themselves at a port of entry to seek asylum. And therefore, they have been forced, especially under the application of Title 42, to seek other, more dangerous ways of attempting to cross into the U.S. to turn themselves into U.S. authorities to seek asylum.
Pedro, you tweeted video of CBP readiness exercise at the San Ysidro border that you said was meant to normalize violence as an acceptable response to people seeking asylum. Can you explain?
CBP, so Customs and Border Protection, especially under Trump and then extended under President Biden, have conducted these readiness exercises where they have several hundred CBP agents that go out at the port of entry. They close many lanes and for sometimes up to 45 minutes will hold these exercises. It's a show of force that use sound grenades. They use mock grenades as well, where they are meant to demonstrate the violence that they would use if there were a large group of people attempting to cross at that point at the port of entry. That has not occurred in many years. But what it does is it's a form of collective punishment because it makes it so violence becomes the acceptable form to respond to people that are seeking safety from harm. And it also conditions other border crossers to blame migrants, asylum seekers, from having to wait even more time at crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. This is something that we should not tolerate. It's not something that should be acceptable as a response to anyone who is seeking safety from the extreme migration patterns that they have been a part of and that they have experienced over the course of attempting to seek safety in the United States.
Over the last month, Pedro, about 100 asylum seekers have been stuck in a kind of open prison between San Diego and Mexico. Can you lay out the human rights standards for people seeking asylum at the border and whether that Customs and Border Patrol is seeking these standards when they hold people there with no food, with hardly any water? Community organizers like yourself out there all day and night trying to hand out food, baby supplies, charging phones, etc.
Yeah, so to describe the scenario, we have people that have crossed into the U.S. in the space known as the enforcement zone. This is between the primary and the secondary border walls. These are 30 feet high walls where they are intending to present themselves to Border Patrol agents to say, I fear for my life, I want to seek asylum. Border Patrol has to comply with national standards that say people need to be provided with basic food, with water, with shelter, and kept away from harm. What we are seeing on the ground at this moment is that there are anywhere between 400 to 500 asylum seekers, including many children who are kept in that location. Border Patrol has pushed people into that location. They have, sometimes they will take their shoelaces away from them. Sometimes they will move them into that location. And that is essentially an open air area without any way of receiving any food, with the exception of civil society that has gathered there and has been providing hot meals for them. What we saw a couple of days ago, for instance, is that Border Patrol provided a single granola bar during the entire day. How is that possible to do that to children, especially those that are very little, who don't know anything about what's going on at the moment? And what we are seeking is for the Border Patrol to comply with these standards. These are standards that were developed back in 2015 after months-long conversations that they need to comply with basic human rights of ensuring that people under their custody are kept in safety. We are not seeing that happening at this moment at the U.S.-Mexico border in San Diego.
Here in California and Texas, the Department of Public Safety and military were seen placing razor wire along the Rio Grande River in Brownsville to reinforce the border. Can you talk about the walls that President Biden said he wouldn't be building, but what's happening there?
What we are seeing is that there are several locations where President Biden is moving forward with building border walls. And these border walls resemble Trump's border walls in terms of the features, such as the height, the type of material that is used. But sometimes they're being branded under another name. In Texas, they are being called levee walls. But they mirror the same exact type of prototypes that President Trump at the time was proclaiming as completely unclimbable. In San Diego, for instance, in the Friendship Park area, he is proceeding with building two 30-foot border walls that will completely decimate the experience that families have had when they arrive at Friendship Park and are able to meet their loved ones, albeit divided by the primary border wall, but at least have that experience. The visual landscape will be transformed. The binational garden that is there will be completely destroyed. And it's something that we are asking President Biden to stop building Donald Trump's border walls. But we don't see any type of leeway in that direction. And we're hoping that civil society continues to lift their voices against these 30-foot border walls that are completely destructive.
Can you explain the harsher criminal consequences for those who cross, which means profit for the private detention centers, the jails along the border?
So for individuals now, after a post Title 42 era, individuals that cross without inspection, who want to seek asylum, could be banned from doing so for 5 years. And this is something that we have not ever seen in terms of the decimation of what the promise of asylum was, that no person should be turned away and placed in greater danger. If someone is banned from seeking asylum, it absolutely ensures that that person likely will face harm either in their home country or in another country. There are the third country bans that we are seeing, what we are now calling the Biden bans. If someone did not seek asylum in a country that they transited through before arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border, then it's likely that the United States will prevent them and block them from seeking asylum in the United States because they did not seek asylum in a third country that they passed through. All of these anti-asylum measures are reconfiguring the concept of asylum to a point where it no longer offers the promise that it did post-World War II, where countries around the world were turning people back and people were dying as a result of not having safe harbor in other countries that should have accepted them.
And can you talk about what is happening now? I mean, this is not just happening along the border. We're broadcasting from New York. Mayor Adams has talked about possibility of putting migrants in a shuttered prison, have already shipping people out of New York City who were brought to New York City to places like Newburgh, New York. This is happening across the country, in Chicago and other places. What do you demand the Biden administration do at this point, Pedro Rios?
That's correct, Amy. And so what we are seeing is that President Biden is placing resources to further militarize the border by sending 1,500 troops to the border. We don't know what their function will be just yet, except that they're saying they will be having administrative tasks. But they do then add to the National Guard troops that certain states like Texas already have at the border. And this addition of additional military troops just paints a picture that migrants will not be welcomed with dignity, but in fact they will be welcomed with extreme force, that they will be turned away. And jurisdictions and other states such as New York should be receiving many more resources to expand the shelter services, to ensure that civil society has the means to transport people, to place asylum seekers in safe houses, at safe places, in safe shelters. We're not seeing the same commitment or dedication from the Biden administration to support those border counties and other states like New York to have the resources necessary to provide the support and help that asylum seekers need at the moment.
Finally, Trump just said he would, if he were president again, he would separate families again and also engage in the largest deportation of migrants in history. But before him, President Obama was dubbed the deporter-in-chief by his own immigrant rights allies. Of course, that was the Obama-Biden administration. Is Biden continuing, do you think, this policy that has gone from Obama to Trump through right now to Biden?
I think President Biden is, unfortunately, and I think this is it's not specific to the Republican Party. What I have been able to see and how I qualify this is that both the Republican and the Democratic Party just have never known how to properly center human rights for people that are seeking safety in the United States. In fact, it becomes a political football where the harsher you can be on border issues, the less protective you can be to migrants, means that that is a way to project their political campaigns and their political goals, undermining the premise that people should be treated with dignity and respect. And that's what we are seeing now under the new Biden transit ban, under the continued construction of 30-foot border walls at Friendship Park and elsewhere, and just the rejection of treating people with dignity as they are seeking safety in the United States.
Pedro Rios, I want to thank you for being with us, Director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico Border Program, speaking to us from San Diego, California. Coming up, a group of House Democrats are urging the Biden administration to lift sanctions on Venezuela and Cuba, which they say are driving people to leave their homes and head to the United States out of economic desperation. Stay with us.
Be reasonable and demand the impossible now. Okay, sing that. Be reasonable and demand the impossible now. All right. First, we'll tear down the towers and bring back the neighborhoods. Start at the bottom, work down to the top. House all the homeless in the great halls of Congress. Ban all the guns and bust all the bad cops. And be reasonable and demand the impossible now. Be reasonable. Demand the impossible now. Well, we free up the freeways for bike lanes and walkways. Fast tracks and toll booths can all be shut down. Make systems for people. Do differences equal instead of the wrong way around. Well, be reasonable and demand the impossible now.
Be Reasonable, performed by Barbara Dane in Democracy Now! Studios in 2018. The legendary singer activist turns 96 years old today. We'll be posting an extended interview with Barbara Dane on our website today. Check it out at democracynow.org. Happy birthday, Barbara Dane. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As Title 42 ends, officials say they expect to see more asylum seekers from many countries, including Cuba and Venezuela. On Wednesday, a group of 21 House Democrats urged President Biden to lift sanctions on both countries, calling them failed and indiscriminate, and adding that, quote, experts widely agree that broad-based U.S. sanctions expanded to an unprecedented level by former President Donald Trump are a critical contributing factor in the current increase in migration, unquote. Well, for more, we go to Francisco Rodriguez, a Venezuelan economist, author of a new report for the Center for Economic Policy and Research titled The Human Consequences of Economic Sanctions. Rodriguez is a professor of public and international affairs at the University of Denver's Corbell School of International Studies. He headed the Venezuelan National Assembly's Economic and Financial Advisory Office under the late President Hugo Chavez. We welcome you back to Democracy Now!, Francisco Rodriguez. Can you lay out what you feel, how these sanctions connect to the migration to the United States from Venezuela and Cuba?
Yes. Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me on the show. Effectively, there is significant evidence surveyed in the report that I just authored, as well as in other academic studies, that economic sanctions have an adverse effect, a major adverse effect on living conditions in target countries. Some of the studies find that the imposition of sanctions by the U.S. Leads to a decline in income per capita of up to 26%. That's the equivalent of causing a Great Depression. Another study found increases or declines in life expectancy of between 1.2 and 1.4 years. That's the equivalent of the mortality effects of the COVID pandemic. So when sanctions are imposed on a country like Venezuela and like Cuba, they lead to a major economic contraction. And Venezuela GDP per capita has fallen by 72%. And this has generated a massive exodus. Almost 25% of the population has left, and many of them are trying to make their way to the border and trying to enter the United States. So definitely we have economically induced migration in both of these countries, and there's a strong contribution of economic sanctions. In the case of Venezuela, sanctions have targeted the oil industry. The oil industry produces 95% of the country's foreign currency revenue. So if the country can't sell oil, it can't import basic goods, it can't import food, it can't import medicines. So living conditions deteriorate markedly, and that's why people want to leave.
So the Biden administration has said it's willing to lift some sanctions against Venezuela in exchange for steps taken by Nicolas Maduro's government, such as not banning opposition candidates from running against him. But most of the sanctions that Biden inherited from Trump remain in place. Your response, and talk about how the humanitarian crisis has increased at home as well in Venezuela by these sanctions.
Yeah, well, I think that response is basically making vulnerable Venezuelans, those who are more oppressed by Maduro, pay the cost of his actions. So to say we're going to lift sanctions which are hurting Venezuelans if Maduro takes steps towards democracy, well, Maduro is probably not going to take those steps. And the people who are going to pay the cost are the Venezuelans and are vulnerable Venezuelans. And you've seen huge deteriorations, huge increases in levels of malnutrition, of mortality, both adult and child mortality in Venezuela. You've seen deteriorations, a decline in wages, where wages have fallen below $5 a month. And all of this, I must stress, is driven by a decline in oil revenues. So Venezuela's economy shrank by 72% in the same period in which oil revenues declined by 93%. And while the cause of the decline in oil revenues, I mean, there are several causes. I'm not claiming in any way that sanctions are the only one, but there's research showing that sanctions have a major effect on oil production. Sanctions, the imposition of sanctions in August 2017, in January of 2019, in February of 2020, is in every single instance associated with accelerations in the rate of decline of oil production. So it's clear that Venezuela doesn't have the foreign currency revenue that it needs in order to keep its economy working and feed its people. And a great part of the responsibility of this lies on U.S. economic sanctions.
Can you also talk about how last year London's high court ruled against Venezuela's president, Maduro, in a $1 billion gold battle? What effect does that have?
Yeah. Well, it has a significant effect, but it's symptomatic of a broader problem, which is that one of the reasons why the Venezuelan government has been unable to deal with the pandemic and unable to deal with recession is that it doesn't have access to its international funds. And those funds, it's barred from access to them, not just because of sanctions, but because of the decision of the United States and the United Kingdom to recognize the government of Juan Guaido, an opposition leader who claimed that he was a legitimate president of Venezuela. And the U.S. and the U.K. broke completely with diplomatic convention when they did this. Typically, what governments do is that they recognize the government that has de facto control over the territory, even if you don't like it, because you realize that that's the government that you need to engage with. So the U.S. recognizes many dictatorships around the world. It recognizes the government of North Korea. It recognizes the government of Iran. But it decided to recognize the Guaido government, and so did the UK, therefore handing it over control over assets such as the international reserves of the central bank, which is what Venezuela needs to address its economic crisis. Venezuela made a proposal to use those reserves in the Bank of England to buy vaccines in the midst of the COVID crisis, but that was rejected because the court is trying to clarify whether what will be the result of that suit, which is a lawsuit between the central bank board that was appointed by the Maduro government and an alternate central bank board that was appointed by the Guaido government. We have a similar problem in the International Monetary Fund. Venezuela did not have access to the funds to fight the COVID emergency that were created by the issuance of special drawing rights at the International Monetary Fund, and that's because the U.S. has blocked recognition of the government that has control of the territory, which is the Maduro government. It's insisted that that the legitimate government, even though the Guaido government has already been dissolved, it's still insisting that the Maduro government not have access to the resources that the IMF approved for all countries to be able to fight the pandemic. So the U.S. spent 25% of GDP in dealing with the pandemic. Latin America spent less than 5% because it didn't have access to the same resources. Venezuela was able to spend less than 1% of its GDP because it was unable to tap the resources that the international community had created and allocated to deal with this emergency.
We don't have much time left, but your report also not only looks at sanctions against Venezuela, against Cuba, but Syria and what that meant, especially with the earthquake that just hit.
Yes. The result surveys 32 studies, of which 30 find negative, consistent effects of sanctions on indicators ranging from GDP per capita to mortality, life expectancy, living conditions in general. In the case of Syria, we have seen also very significant negative effects. And in fact, sanctions have interfered with earthquake relief. Earlier in the year, GoFundMe actually suspended the any attempts, any accounts requesting the raising of funds for Syria earthquake relief. And that was as a response. It's a phenomenon known as overcompliance. It's not the U.S. claims that there are humanitarian exceptions, and it puts humanitarian exceptions in the regulations that it publishes. But the reality is that the exceptions are so vague and so hard to follow that most financial institutions say, we're not going to take the risk of getting into trouble, and we're not going to process transactions for countries like Syria. And therefore, you see that, and you see this systematically across the board, the humanitarian exceptions are not effective. And in the case of Iran, for example, you found that the medicines that were not available in Iran during the periods of sanctions. Out of 73 medicines, 70 of them were in the OFAC exemptions list. But it's still the case that no bank would process the transactions, given that the country was a sanctioned country. So sanctions impede the access to funds that are necessary to cover humanitarian aid in cases of emergency relief, such as those of the Syria earthquake.
Francisco Rodriguez, I want to thank you for that very quick analysis of the effect of sanctions from Venezuela to Syria. Venezuelan economist, thank you so much for being with us from the University of Denver, speaking to us from Aurora. Headed the National Assembly's Economic and Financial Advisory Office under Venezuela's late President Hugo Chavez. His new report for the Center for Economic Policy and Research is titled The Human Consequences of Economic Sanctions. Coming up, Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been freed after his arrest sparked mass protests and a number of deaths. Stay with us. Support the Second Amendment in front of second graders. They get shot, turning red over, playing hot potato. These grown men won't enter rooms, say we'll stop them later. Can stop the gator, no matter what the new cases. Identifying by DNA and shoelaces. He say we move forward, backwards two paces. All these right-wing governors in the school faces, with all these young kids suffering, making new statements, lobbying for law changes, getting hounded and accused. Now who really is abused, indoctrinated to stop debating? Only right and wrong answers if you ask DeSantis. Watch the fascists on campus, doesn't like the colors splashed on canvas. Got the mask on, managed to avoid lung damage, but it won't block a gunshot. Can't drink a beer, but your son's got a gun cock. Don't talk to me about a knife fight when 25 are getting dumped off in a matter of seconds. Yet we can't ban a bump stock. A one drop of blood's never bled from your family. Every nation knows it's America's calamity. Make money, money. Making lots of guns, make money, money, making lots of guns, shaking all you down. Tons of Guns 23 by Darius Rhodes and Reason. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Pakistan. Earlier today, the Islamabad High Court granted bail for 2 weeks to former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, whose arrest earlier this week sparked mass protests. On Tuesday, paramilitary forces arrested Khan on corruption charges, but then on Thursday, Pakistan's Supreme Court ruled his arrest was invalid and unlawful. Khan had served as Pakistan's prime minister from 2018 to 2022, when he was ousted from office in what he described as a, quote, U.S.-backed regime change plot backed by his opposition. He's now blamed the military. Supporters of his political party, the PTI, say the latest charges are politically motivated and part of a broader campaign to silence Khan. In an attempt to quell the protests, Pakistan's police issued an emergency order earlier today to ban gatherings in Islamabad. Pakistan has also suspended mobile broadband and blocked access to social media apps, disrupting the lives of millions. Meanwhile, human rights groups accused Pakistani forces of using excessive force on supporters of Imran Khan, who've taken to the streets in recent days. At least 10 protesters have been killed. Nearly 3,000 Khan supporters have been arrested. We're joined now by Mohammad Hanif. He's an award-winning writer and journalist based in Karachi. He's a former editor of the BBC Urdu service in London, where he's joining us from today. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Mohammad Hanif. It's great to have you with us. Explain what's happening. Why was Imran Khan arrested, and now why was he released?
I think they've been trying to arrest Imran Khan for quite a few months now. The main purpose is quite obvious. Elections are due. And they want to keep him out of the electoral race. Either they want to disqualify him or they want to put him behind bars. That seems to be the obvious purpose, because he was just thrown out of the government a year ago. And since then, he has been on a war path. And that's not new. Almost every single prime minister in Pakistan's history at some point has fallen out with the army, which is considered the all-powerful in Pakistan. But what Imran Khan has managed to do is that he's managed to polarize what's called establishment in Pakistan, which is the higher judiciary and military itself. So people were hoping that after they put him behind bars, they'll be managed to throw away the key, and that's where he will stay. But he was there under arrest for 2 days, and then Supreme Court, the Chief Justice himself called him, said, "I'm very happy to see you." Then from a lockup, put him into a state guest house, asked him to basically invite his friends over and have an easy night's sleep. And then today he appeared in the court again, and he was granted bail. So now he's a free man to move. So basically what Imran Khan has managed to achieve is, which no other politician has, I think, in the past, is that he's managed to polarize the establishment itself. So they don't quite know what to do with him, because they put him behind the bars. And as Imran Khan has warned, if you arrest me, the country will burn. And the country did burn. And now they've released him. But there are dozens and dozens of cases against him, some very flimsy, some substantial. And I think they will probably go after him again.
He seems to be extremely popular throughout Pakistan. Can you explain who his supporters are and just give us the overall political landscape, why at this point they arrested him?
We keep hearing that he is extremely popular. And the interesting thing is that he's popular amongst people who are basically used to be a bit apolitical. In every democracy, there's a chunk of people who actually hate politics. So there were lots of haters in Pakistan who did not like the way things were going. And they're usually middle-class people, a lot of them. They're people, lots of women who were politically disengaged, lots of young people who were not interested in politics or just hated the idea of these old politicians who've been running the country. These were also the same people who loved the army. And when Imran Khan came into power, it was a quite well-known fact that he was groomed by the army. He was supported by the army. While he was in power, he said repeatedly that he and army, they were on one page. In fact, he's basically confessed that he was a puppet for the army, that everything that he did while he was in power, he did because army told him to do so. But when he was thrown out of power after a no confidence vote, he went on a war path. So all these people who were supporting him and supporting the army, now they have turned against the army. So look at it like a lover's quarrel, and those quarrels can be very, very bitter and sometimes very violent. So that's why we saw what we saw in Lahore. The army commander who basically controls Lahore and in a way is kind of, you know, sort of probably more powerful than any politician in Lahore. His house was ransacked, set on fire. It was looted. So army is probably just beginning to realize that they have created something that they cannot control anymore.
Imran Khan described the coup that replaced him as a U.S.-backed regime change, but then seemed to shift and blame the Pakistani military. Can you explain the dynamic there?
A fun fact about Imran Khan is that he can say something today, and he can say completely opposite tomorrow, and his supporters would still love him. So he's a man that you cannot accuse of that he's contradicting himself. Because that is not his weakness, that's almost his strength. So when he was removed, he did say that it was a U.S.-backed conspiracy. Then he changed his mind very many times. He said that it was Pakistani generals who were traitors, who betrayed him and betrayed the country. He's called them all kinds of names. And since then, we keep hearing, you guys probably know this better, that he's been hiring lobbyists in Washington, D.C. to kind of to smooth things over with the United States establishment. I don't even know if they're interested or not. But as a Pakistani, one thing that I found a bit scary in the last few weeks is that there's this dude called Zalmay Khalilzad, is I think his name, who kind of first tried to liberate Iraq. and then Afghanistan, and we both know what happened there. So
was the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan?
Yes, he was. So, and then before, I think he was involved somehow in Iraq as well. So every time we hear his name, we hear mass murder, basically, of a world class. So he's somebody who's been campaigning on his behalf. I have no idea whether he's a paid lobbyist or just because he's out of job and he's looking for another cause, another country to save. So I would only, as a citizen, say that God save Pakistan from Zalmay Khalilzad and the likes of him.
Do you fear a military takeover in Pakistan now, or would you say that's already happened?
I think Pakistan is in such a big economic mess right now. I mean, till last month and even now, people are standing in long queues just to purchase, flour to make their bread. And things are so bad that they haven't been so bad in a long time. And army would have moved in if they knew that they could handle the country economically. And which they can't. Things are as desperate as they can be. So they kind of they are trying to run things, but it seems that they can't anymore. And if they resort to brute force, which they have done in the past, I think we will get into probably a much bigger mess than we are in right now. And I think probably army fears that too. So I don't think there will be any direct takeover by the army. They will try to do what they've been doing in the past. They'll stay on the sidelines, and they will try to run things. But increasingly, it seems that they're not able to do what they've been able to do in the past.
Mohammed Hanif, we want to thank you for being with us, award-winning Pakistani writer and journalist based in Karachi, former editor of the BBC Urdu service in London, speaking to us from London. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We end today's show in Serbia, which is reeling from a pair of mass shootings that left 17 people dead. On May 3rd, a 13-year-old boy, a student, went on a rampage at a school in the capital, Belgrade, killing 8 students and a school guard. It was Serbia's first mass school shooting. The following day, a 21-year-old Serbian man shot dead 8 people nearby. The shooting shocked the country and led to quick calls for sweeping gun control measures, and Serbia's President Aleksandar Vučić vowed to completely disarm the country. More than 6,000 unregistered guns and weapons have already been turned in after the government announced a month-long amnesty on illegal weapons. Nearly 300,000 rounds of ammunition have also been surrendered. We go now to the Serbian journalist, Liljana Smalovic. She is a former editor of Politika, the oldest daily newspaper in the Balkans, also is a columnist for Belgrade Political Weekly magazine. We welcome you back to Democracy Now!, Liljana. Thank you so much for being with us. Can you first lay out what happened and then the country's response, the population? In fact, there's about to be yet another anti-gun mass mobilization in Belgrade today.
First time, you know, their sense of security has been taken away completely. So what they're thinking now is my child safe at school? This other mass murder happened in a sleepy little suburb of Belgrade. They're wondering, can we still meet up late with neighbors and walk home afterwards? So there's this shock and surprise and something that's never happened before that takes...
Looks like we... Liljana was frozen in her Skype last week after 17 people were killed in the two mass shootings, including 8 children. Tens of thousands of people joined protests against gun violence in Belgrade, demanding top government officials resign. This is a protester.
It is tragic that so many kids killed by their peers were buried in a short period of time. This is a low point. We are already used to what happens in Texas, but there, weapons are openly purchased. And here, Where do they get the firearms? It is a disaster.
Liliana Smilovich, if you could respond to what he's saying. We're still having trouble with getting Liliana. This is the Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, speaking last week at a news conference in Belgrade after both mass shootings.
Everyone who has a weapon, and that's around 400,000 individuals, and I'm not talking about hunting weapons, will have to go through revision, and after there won't be more than 30,000 to 40,000 of them. We'll practically conduct a complete disarmament of Serbia. For owning an illegal weapon, penalties will be much more severe, almost double. Of course, even that will not be enough for the small number of weapons that will remain. For hunters, who are usually more disciplined, and for everyone else, we will conduct biannual and annual exams of gun owners, including medical, psychiatric, and psychological evaluations. If deemed necessary by the authorities, a substance use test will be conducted within 48 hours.
Let's see if we have Liliana Smilovic back. And if we do, it seems like Serbia is mobilizing against gun violence much faster than the United States. You've had two mass shootings. We have on average at least one a day in the United States. Explain what's happening.
Well, what's happening is that we have a political hegemon in power. He has been in power for over 10 years. He has a majority in parliament. He's a hands-on president. He's also the president of the ruling party. So when he promises something, when he says he's going to move on something, he moves on it and people know that he can deliver. So the protests, the mass opposition protests that we've had a couple of days ago, and we're expecting another major protest tonight, these protests are not so much against his measures. People, by and large, approve the measures that the president has announced. People are surrendering their weapons en masse. He just announced today that 9,000 weapons were surrendered, which is more than had happened in four previous campaigns of the sort, where people were asked to turn in their unregistered weapons and there would be no consequences if they do. But the protests are really the protests against this long-serving president who is being accused of being a dictator, and he truly politically is omnipotent. So the opposition sees this crisis of people's sense of security as a good opportunity to try to dislodge or destabilize the government and extort some important political concessions. They want several key people in the government that are known as personal choices of the president to be fired. They want two of the most popular political stations to lose their broadcasting licenses, at least for national frequencies, and only to remain cable companies. So they have huge demands, and they figured that this is a good moment to try to win some concessions from a very strong and stable, otherwise stable government.
You are, to say the least, a global observer. You've seen what's happened in the United States, and then you see what's happening in Serbia. How are the mass shootings in the United States perceived from there? And this immediate crackdown on guns, especially illegal guns on the streets of Serbia, like we haven't seen in the United States ever.
We are a society that's just as deeply polarized politically as the United States. So we used to look at the United States and say, oh, that happens there because they have all those weapons and they have these, you know, open carry and all this. But we also felt that we were better and that this kind of thing could not happen here. And immediately there were political accusations. A government minister who was forced to resign said, this is what comes from your so-called Western values. Well, the opposition responded, no, this is what comes from Putinism, from being pro-Russian. So that was the debate. But by and large, people approve of restrictive measures, and they cannot understand that the United States is unable to do anything about their problem. So people are saying, okay, this has not been imported from the United States. We are simply part of the big world. And these are things that happen in that outer world. And some things that are happening in this society have a lot to do with what's happening in other more developed societies, the societies that we are aspiring.
Well, Liliana Smilovic, we're going to have to leave it there. We thank you so much for being with us. Serbian journalist joining us from Belgrade, Serbia, where two mass shootings took place one day after another. One perpetrated by a 13-year-old student who gunned down his classmates and a guard in the school. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Aaron Dooley. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Felstein, Gozder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astujo, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Our director, Becca Staley.
You are listening to WRCT, Pittsburgh.
How many roads must a man walk down before they call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever? A mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? How many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? How many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? How many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing. The answer is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Good morning. Kenny Joe here. You're in Pinckney Hall on WRCT Pittsburgh, broadcasting from the beautiful campus of Carnegie Mellon University. The song we started out with was Peter, Paul, and Mary's version of Blowing in the Wind, the first song that Bob Dylan wrote that became widely popular. At least that's Kenny Joe's recollection
I was unable to have my crack research staff back that up. But as far as I know, that's the first Bob Dylan cover that got into the top 10. For the rest of today, we're going to be playing songs by and about Mr. Dylan, except for the next set. The next set's going to have nothing to do with our Nobel laureate. It'll be the Pinckney Hall New Music Set. So we'll get into that as soon as we tell you about one of our fine partners here at WRCT, our fine underwriters, the Irma Freeman Center. The Irma Freeman Center for Imagination joins you in supporting WRCT Pittsburgh. Located on Penn Avenue in the Garfield neighborhood of Pittsburgh, the Erman Freeman Center for Imagination has been contributing to the educational and cultural landscape of the city of Pittsburgh for over a decade. They host a vast array of events and exhibitions and have regular gallery hours every Sunday, 2 to 5 p.m., or by appointment. Or you can visit them during Unblurred on the first Friday of every month from 6 to 9 p.m. For more information, dial 412-924-0634 or visit irmafreeman.com.